Chapter 16, Mein Kampf.
Kill every Jew.
Passions inflamed by the atrocities perpetrated at Badar, Muhammad and his henchmen immediately turned a covetous eye toward the Yathrib Jews. The Prophet besieged them and established the Nazi mindset of Islam. Hitler behaved the same way. After using violence and deceit to disrupt the German political system, he schemed himself into power, opening the first concentration camp, Dachau, within weeks of his appointment as chancellor. The implements of his pathological rage were stormtroopers. Steeped in the hate-mongering rhetoric of Mein Kampf, they mercilessly besieged the Jews for political power and economic gain, offering them a one-way ticket to hell. I believe that Adolf Hitler was influenced by Islam and inspired by the same spirit that possessed dear Prophet. Their doctrines were indistinguishable, as were their deeds.
Tabari, after Muhammad killed many Quraysh polytheists at Badar, the Jews were envious and behaved badly toward him, saying, "Muhammad has not met anyone who is good at fighting. Had he met with us, he would have had a real battle." They also infringed the treaty in various ways.
Since the Jews never defended themselves against Muhammad, it is inconceivable that they picked a fight. As for Jews being envious of a pirate, now terrorist, I don't think so. But Muhammad needed an excuse. It's hard to square genocidal rage with being God's messenger. According to Ishaq, the treaty
established the Jews in their religion and gave them rights to their property.
Consider the arrogance and ignorance of these words. An anti-Semite claimed to have
established the Jews in their religion.
Not only was he 1,800 years late, his religion was the antithesis of their covenant. As for him granting their property rights, the Jews had lived in Yathrib for 1,000 years. They built the town into the thriving community it had become. Muhammad had just slithered in.
Ishaq, the document stated reciprocal obligations. In the name of Allah, Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim, this is a treaty for Muhammad the Prophet, governing relations between Muslims. They are one ummah, or community, to the exclusion of all men.
Chairman Mao had formed his commune and named himself dictator. He told his comrades,
"Believers are friends of one another to the exclusion of all outsiders. No separate peace shall be made when Muslims are fighting in Allah's cause, and Muslims must avenge bloodshed in Allah's cause."
So far, it's intolerant, violent, and dictatorial.
"Whenever you differ about a matter, it must be referred to Allah and Muhammad."
But since Allah never spoke, obeying the latter sufficed.
Ishaq, the Jews shall contribute to the cost of war so long as they are fighting alongside the believers. The Jews have their religion, the Muslims have theirs.
Holy camel wreck! Don't these boys think? Allah and Muhammad have told us 100 times that Judaism was Islam. The Torah was said to have been Islamic scripture, foretelling the blessed arrival of this Arab prophet. But not to worry about these little religious misunderstandings. Muhammad had become a warlord.
None of them shall go out to war unless they have Muhammad's permission. The Jews must pay, however, for as long as the war lasts. If any dispute or controversy should arise, it must be referred to Allah and Muhammad, his apostle. If the Jews are called to make peace, they must, except in the case of holy war. Allah approves of this document. Fear Allah.
The manifesto was allegedly signed with these egotistical words.
Ishaq, Allah's apostle, the Lord of the Muslims, leader of the Allah-fearing, messenger of the Lord of the worlds, the peerless and unequaled.
The egotistical Hitler had nothing on this guy. The political treaty was allegedly drawn up after Muhammad's 50 immigrants invaded Yathrib, a town of some 40,000 inhabitants. Muslims claimed that the Jews, who were craftsmen, merchants, and farmers, not warriors, signed the quasi-military accord. Further, they attest that the Jews agreed to acquiesce to Muhammad's supreme authority on all matters. But since the second surah said that the Jews had mocked Muhammad's every word, A total suspension of reason is required to trust this absurd position. And let's be clear. By the 7th century, the Jews had been pummeled by the best and sent into diaspora. They had no army, and it had been 900 years since they had scored a military victory. So the reason the first Muslims tried so hard to establish this impossible scenario was that Muhammad's behavior towards the Jews was impossible to justify without it. And the Prophet's wanton behavior must be excused, or at least explained, or he couldn't have been a prophet. The real motivation for what was about to occur was directly related to the failure of Badr. The caravan got away. Muhammad needed money. The 8th surah was named
The Spoils of War
because Islam was being established through piracy. The sword had replaced words, and once a mercenary machine is built, it must be fed. Its ravenous appetite requires ever larger and more frequent fixes. And the Jews were right in a way. Badr was an overhyped temper tantrum in a man-sized sandbox. It was a clash of misfits and merchants, not titans. Muhammad, in an effort to establish his authority, oversold the whole bloody affair. 1,000 angels in white turbans decapitating out-of-shape businessmen was a little hard to swallow. Ishaq reports,
What happened to the Banu Kanuka?
The wealthiest Jewish tribe in Yathrib,
was that Muhammad assembled them in their marketplace and said, Jews, beware lest Allah bring on you the kind of vengeance which he brought upon the Quraysh. Accept Islam,
which means submission,
and become Muslims,
which means surrender.
You know that I am a prophet. You will find me in your scriptures and in Allah's covenant with you.
Muhammad was proclaiming himself to be the Messiah once again. Yet in actuality, he had become the 7th century embodiment of the Antichrist. Let's compare Muhammad and Yeshua to see who better reflected the nature of the biblical God, and thus had messianic qualities. Based upon the scriptures, Yeshua was the perfect reflection of Yahweh. He was loving, rational, miraculous, prophetic, truthful, sacrificial, and wise. Everything he said and did was in perfect harmony with the Torah, the Psalms, and the prophets. He never abused, attacked, enslaved, nor robbed anyone. Anger was only demonstrated when it was justified, and even then it was directed against religious institutions, not men. He hated false doctrines, false gods, and false prophets, to be sure. These things separated men from him. Yeshua was like Yahweh because he is Yahweh. Muhammad, in contrast, is the perfect reflection of Allah. Like his spirit, he was lustful and hateful. He couldn't perform a miracle, nor could he conceive or fulfill a prophecy. He was irrational, deceitful, self-serving, violent, and foolish. Everything he said was a gross corruption of the Bible or a regurgitated version of his pagan past. Anger was his trademark, and he despised everyone who challenged him. He led billions away from Yahweh. He abused tens of thousands, stealing their property, raping women, selling children into slavery, and massacring men. Muhammad was like Allah because he was Allah. Recognizing this,
in Tabari and Ishaq, the Jews of the Banu Kanuka replied, Muhammad, do you think that we are like your people? Do not be deluded by the fact that you met a people with no knowledge and you made good use of your opportunity.
The Jews knew right from wrong because they were literate and schooled in their scriptures. They knew that Muhammad was a charlatan, a false prophet pursuing his own ambition. Pirate and terrorist didn't mesh with the biblical profile of a prophet, much less the Messiah. But as with all insecure liars, Muhammad attacked those who had the will and sense to expose him.
Ishaq, say to those who do not believe you, you will be vanquished and gathered into hell, an evil resting place. You have already had a sign by way of the two forces which met, the apostles' companions and the Quraysh. One side fought in Allah's cause. Verily, that was an example for the discerning.
Indeed it was. And that's why understanding Badar is essential if we want to discern the truth about Muhammad, and thereby predict how Muslims will respond today. Although we are never told how or why, Islamic apologists insist.
Tabari and Ishaq. The Banu Kanuka were the first Jews to infringe the agreement between them and the messenger. The campaign of the prophet against the Banu Kanuka was in Shawwal, March 27, 624, in the second year of the Hijra,
which is the migration from Mecca, demonstrating a pattern that would be followed for all time by Muslim statesmen. Muhammad unilaterally reneged on the treaty he claimed governed the affairs of Yathrib. As you listen to these words, consider the wisdom of forcing Israel to sign a land for peace accord with its Muslim neighbors.
Tabari, Gabriel,
actually Satan,
brought down the following verse to the messenger. If you apprehend treachery from any people with whom you have a treaty, retaliate by breaking off relations with them.
This became Quran 8:58.
When Gabriel had finished delivering this verse, the prophet said, I fear the Banu Kanuka. It was on the basis of this verse that Muhammad advanced upon them.
The Quran, from this point forward, is simply a series of situational scriptures. Allah stands ever ready to endorse whatever his prophet desires. Further, Muhammad just confirmed that my interpretation of the breaking treaties verse was accurate. In Islam, treaties are used to lure nations into a false sense of peace so that they become easier prey.
Tabari and Ishaq. Allah's apostle besieged the Banu Kanuka until they surrendered at his discretion unconditionally.
These are just words. They sound so benign. Yet consider what lies beneath them. The Kanuka township was comprised of several thousand families, maybe more. The Jews had lived among Arabs without incident for 1,000 years. They had built a life worth living. Then one day a bloodthirsty thug returned from a terrorist raid and knocked on their door. He ordered them to surrender their lives, their property, and their souls to him. When they said no, Muhammad had his militants surround their homes. The Muslims deprived the Jews of water and food. We can appreciate their suffering, because this is exactly what Der Fuhrer did to the Jews of the Warsaw ghettos.
In Tabari and Ishaq, Abdallah,
an Arab chief,
rose up when Allah had put them in his power, and said, Muhammad, treat my ally well, for the Kanuka are a confederate of the Khazraj. The prophet ignored him, and so Abdallah repeated his request.
For the centuries before Muhammad's arrival, tribal alliances had formed the foundation of peace in the Arab world. There were no policemen or courts, as none were needed. Caravans traveled safely, and people lived in harmony, because they had established a means to work together and to work things out. But Muhammad was a breath away from destroying all of that. He would transform his world into a killing machine, poised to plunder Arabia, and then all mankind.
Ishaq. The prophet turned away from him, so Abdallah put his hand on the collar of the messenger's robe. Muhammad said, Let go of me. He was so angry his face turned black. Then he said, Damn you, let me go. Abdallah replied, No, by God, I will not let you go until you treat my ally humanely. There are 700 men among them, some with mail, who defended me from my foes when I needed their help. And now would you mow them down in a single morning? By God, I do not feel safe around here anymore. I am afraid of what the future may have in store. So the messenger said, You can have them.
Muhammad wouldn't tolerate any affront to his supreme authority, which is why he turned black with anger. And make no mistake, he was ready, willing, and able to mow the Jews down. There is a subtlety in the unabridged version of this dialogue that I would like to bring to your attention. The Jews were described as having armor and coats of mail, but no swords. And that's because the Kanuka were the gold and metalsmiths of the town. They made jewelry for their wives and armor for the Arabs. And that's why Muhammad targeted them first. They had what he coveted, money and the implements of war. When trying to understand or predict Muhammad's behavior, Always keep the Quraysh bargain and satanic verses in mind. Muhammad's kin knew him better than we do. They successfully tempted him with money, power, and women. The Prophet was even willing to renounce his God and his prophetic authority to acquire these things. If you doubt the veracity of the Quraysh assessment, listen to what happened next.
Tabari, the Prophet said, "Let them go. May Allah curse them, and may he curse Abdallah with them." So the Muslims let them go. Then Muhammad
went back on his word and
gave orders to expel the Jews. Allah gave their property as booty to his messenger. The Kanuka did not have any farmland, as they were goldsmiths. The Prophet took many weapons belonging to them and the tools of their trade. The person who took charge of their expulsion from Yathrib, along with their children, was Ubadah. He accompanied them as far as Dubab, saying, "The farther you go, the better." Bukhari, he accompanied them as far as Dubab, saying, "The farther you go, the better." He exiled all of the Kanuka Jews from Medina.
For good measure, Muhammad claimed Allah revealed his Hitlerish warning to leaders like Abdallah.
Ishaq, Muslims, take not Jews and Christians as friends. Whoever protects them becomes one of them. They become diseased and will earn a similar fate.
In reply, Abdallah said,
Ishaq, I fear this change of circumstance may end up overtaking us. So Allah replied, "He will be sorry for his thoughts. True believers perform prostrations. They pay the tax. They bow in homage. They renounce their agreements with the Jews. They are Hezbollah, Allah's party."
Yes, it's true. The terrorist organization Hezbollah is Allah's party. Surely you're not surprised. It's a simple story with haunting repercussions. A self-proclaimed prophet fled his flea-infested mud hut of a town in shame and shuffled into a city filled with literate, moral, and prosperous Jews. The profiteer convoluted their scriptures, proclaimed himself their Messiah, and commanded them to submit to his authority. Then he besieged them, forcing them, men, women, and children, into the desert to die. He stole their treasure, dividing their homes among his militants. Islam had hit a new low, but rest assured, this would not be its darkest hour.
Tabari, some say there were three Ghazwa,
Muslim raids,
led by the messenger himself and one Maghazi raiding party, which he dispatched between his expeditions to Bazaar and the campaign against the Kanuka.
Others say one event followed the other. I share this so that you might know that I have not jumped from the viciousness of Bidar to the wanton immorality of the Kanuka siege, skipping over a sea of pious religious activities. There were none. One battle followed the next. Muhammad dropped all pretense of religious trappings. He became a pirate pursuing plunder, a terrorist, nothing more. Before we leave this troubled time, let's return to the surah that approved exiling Jews. In this passage, Allah takes credit for Muhammad's actions, something that is both bizarre and sinister.
Quran 59, verse 2. It was Allah who drove the Jewish people from their
Yathrib
homes and into exile. They refused to believe. You did not think that they would go away. And they imagined that their strongholds would protect them against Allah. But Allah's torment came at them from where they did not suspect. He terrorized them. Their homes were destroyed. So learn a lesson, men who have eyes. This is my warning. Had I not decreed the expulsion of the Jews, banishing them into the desert, I would have punished them in this world. And in the next, they shall taste the punishment of hellfire. This is because they resisted Allah and his messenger. If anyone resists Allah, verily Allah is severe in punishment, stern in reprisal.
Their only crime was resisting Islam. So by that logic, all non-Muslims are fair game. The obviously powerless and thus delusional Islamic spirit said,
Quran 59 verse 6, What Allah gave as booty to his messenger, he has taken away from the Jews. For this you made no raid. Allah gives his messenger lordship over whom he will. Whatever booty Allah has given to Muhammad and taken away from the Jewish people of the townships belongs to Allah and to his apostle. So take what the messenger assigns to you and deny yourselves that which he withholds and fear Allah, for he is severe in punishment.
This all-in-one Islamic verse is the reason the religion of Islam cannot be fixed. It features racism, violent hostility, banishment, destruction, thievery, wrath, terror, forced exile, severe punishment, and threats for those who resist. A doctrine this perverse will continue to fester and grow. It will infect men's minds and souls until the whole world is consumed in war. Year 3 of the Islamic era opens with a story. The headline reads,
"The Murder of Ka'b bin Ashraf, the Evil Genius of the Jews."
The drama begins with some boasting.
Tabari, "The Prophet sent messengers to the people of Medina, announcing the good news of the victory granted to him by Allah at Badr. They listed the names of the polytheists they had killed."
Only a sick man gloats over the death of civilians. I recognize that you have been overwhelmed with a steady diet of revolting stories, but I want to remind you that I am not avoiding religious stuff to prove that Muhammad was a terrorist. There hasn't been a single nurturing, loving, positive, tolerant, or even remotely religious thought presented in the Islamic Hadith since we arrived at Yathrib, today's Medina. While there is no message of salvation in Islam, there is an overwhelming need for one. Simply stated, Muhammad was unable to give Muslims a reason to live, so he gave them a reason to kill.
Ishaq, "Ka'b bin Ashraf was from the Jewish clan of Banu Nadir. When he heard the news, he said, 'Can this be true? Did Muhammad actually kill these people? These were fine men. If Muhammad has slain them, then the belly of the earth is a better place for us than its surface.'"
Ka'b understood the danger of mixing false religion, booty, and swords. The future looked ominous. For Muhammad, the only good non-Muslim was a dead one.
Ishaq, "When the enemy of Allah became convinced the report was true, he set out for Mecca. He began to arouse people against Muhammad."
In other words, he exposed him.
"He recited verses in sympathy for the Quraysh men Muhammad had cast into the pit. Ka'b Ashraf composed the following poetic lines: 'The blood spilled at Badr calls to its people. They cry and weep. The best men were slain and thrown into a pit.'"
Poets were the journalists of Muhammad's day. Apart from the Jews, most Arabians were illiterate, so poetry became the most effective means of disseminating a message. The poem Ka'b wrote on this occasion was 7 lines long. There wasn't a violent word among them. Ka'b urged the good people of Yathrib to
"drive off that fool of yours so that you might be safe from the talk that makes no sense. Why do you taunt those who mourn over their dead? They lived good lives, and as such we must remember them. But now you have become like jackals."
Astute, concise, and accurate.
Tabari, "Then Ka'b composed poetry about some Muslim women."
As we have learned, chivalry had no place in Islam, so this made the Prophet angry. If Ka'b had written of lust, pedophilia, and incest, I'm sure Muhammad would have been more understanding. With these next words, Muhammad ordered his first assassination. While only 2 men were slain, the nature of his crime has far-reaching implications. Every detail haunts us today.
Tabari, "The Prophet said, 'Who will rid me of Ashraf?' Muhammad bin Masalma said, 'I will rid you of him, Messenger of Allah. I will kill him.' 'Do it then,' he said, 'if you can.'"
One of the things that makes Islam lethal is that men are ever ready to kill on the Prophet's command. Ordering the assassination of a journalist for exposing a false prophet, a pirate, and a terrorist is serious business. Let's check another source to make sure we have this right.
Bukhari. The Prophet said, "Who is ready to kill Ka'b bin Ashraf, who has really hurt Allah and his apostle?" Muhammad bin Maslama said, "O Allah's apostle, do you want me to kill him?" He replied in the affirmative.
That wasn't any better. Let's see what the earliest source has to say.
Ishaq. "Who will rid me of Ashraf?" Maslama said, "I will deal with him for you. O apostle, I will kill him." Muhammad said, "Do so if you can."
Returning to Tabari.
Muhammad bin Maslama was quiet for 3 days, neither eating nor drinking more than would keep him alive. The Prophet summoned him and said, "Why have you given up food and drink?" "O Prophet, I said something and I do not know if I can fulfill it." "All that is incumbent on you is to try," Muhammad replied.
This response is chilling when you consider that the subject was assassination.
Ishaq and Tabari. Muhammad bin Maslama said, "O Messenger, we shall have to tell lies." "Say what you like," Muhammad replied. "You are absolved, free to say whatever you must."
The moment this man walked out of the room, Muhammad must have doubled over laughing. The stooge was willing to commit murder, yet he was concerned about lying. And while that's hilarious in a macabre sort of way, consider the value of Muhammad's absolution. Since he had just approved lying, it couldn't have been worth the air it took to offer it. But Muhammad's assassin believed him, and that is why false prophets and corrupt doctrines are so diabolical. Muslim militants still believe him. While the circumstances are bizarre, as the orders are vile, we do have another first. Islam was the first religion to command its faithful to murder and deceive. But since that's a serious charge, let's triple-check our sources.
Bukhari, Allah's apostle said, "Who is willing to kill Ka'b bin Ashraf, who has hurt Allah and his apostle?" Thereupon, Muhammad bin Maslama got up, saying, "O Allah's apostle, would you like me to kill him?" The Prophet said, "Yes." Maslama said, "Then allow me to say false things in order to deceive him." The Prophet said, "You may say such things."
Returning to Tabari, we are told that Maslama
made a plan to kill Ka'b, the enemy of Allah. Before they went to him, they sent Abu ahead. When he arrived, they spoke together for a while. They recited verses to one another, for Abu was something of a poet.
Consider the depth of the corruption necessary for a man to lure another to his death by reciting poetry. And as you listen on, think of how the Palestinians use their "We are suffering under Israeli oppression," tale of woe to deceive us today, drawing us ever closer to war.
Tabari and Ishaq. Then Abu said, "Ka'b, I have come to you about a matter which I want you to keep secret." "Go ahead," he replied. "The arrival of the Prophet Muhammad has been an affliction for us." Abu said, "Most Arabs are now hostile to us. We cannot travel along the roads, and the result is that our families are facing ruin. We are all suffering." Ka'b replied, "I warned you, Abu, that things would turn out like this." Abu said, "I would like you to sell us some food. We will give you some collateral and make a firm contract. Please treat us generously."
The Arabs who call themselves Palestinians delivered this same message to Bill Clinton during the Oslo negotiations, and he gave them the guns they now use to kill Jewish women and children. Bush is following in his footsteps, aiding, arming, and training the Muslims in Iraq that will turn those same weapons one day on the Jews. Lies remain seductive. Returning to al-Bukhari, we find Maslama having a similar chat with Ka'b.
Bukhari, Muhammad bin Maslama went to Ka'b and said, "The Prophet Muhammad demands payment of zakat tax from us, and he has brought us nothing but trouble. I have come to borrow something from you." On that, Ka'b said, "I knew you would tire of him." Maslama said, "But since we have followed him, we do not want to leave until we see how all of this is going to turn out."
Although Ka'b Ashraf was but one man, the circumstances surrounding his assassination provide us with an unparalleled window into the Islamic mindset, their means and motives. the deception that is being presented on behalf of Muhammad should be a warning to us today. When Muslim spokespeople deceive our media, they are following their prophet's orders and relying on his absolution. Now, as then, economic interests cloud our judgment.
Tabari, Abu said, I have some companions with me who think the same way I do. I would like to bring them to you so that you can do business with them as well. We will deposit sufficient weapons with you to guarantee the payment of our debt. Abu wanted to fool the Jew so that he would not be suspicious about the weapons when they came in bearing them. Cobb replied, Your weapons will be a satisfactory guarantee. Abu went back to his companions and informed them of what had happened. He told them to grab their swords and join him. Before leaving, they went to the house of the messenger. Muhammad walked with them as far as Baghi al-Gharad. Then he sent them off, saying, Go in Allah's name. O Allah, help them.
Assassinate the outspoken Jew.
Then the prophet went back home. It was a moonlit night, and they went forward until they reached Cobb's house.
I believe we will see Muslims use this strategy to kill millions of Jews. They will bring American, Russian, Saudi, Syrian, Iranian, and Egyptian weapons into the West Bank under the ruse of guaranteeing to protect the Jews from Islamic terrorists. Yet they will be used by the Islamic terrorists to slaughter Jews. It is why the Land for Peace process is the most direct path to world war. Before we go on, recognize what Ashraf represented. Cobb was a poet, a journalist. The reason Muhammad singled him out for assassination was to control the public debate. This murder was about politics, not religion. It was about power and control, nothing else. The model Muhammad established still performs as intended. Virtually every member of the American media is afraid to do what Ashraf did. They are afraid to expose Islam. They know that Muslims assassinate men and women with the courage to denounce their doctrine. As a result, true Islam remains a well-guarded secret.
Ishaq. Then Abu called out to him. He had recently married, and he leapt up in his bed. His wife took hold of the sheets and said to the strange voice, You are a fighting man, as only a man of war leaves his house at an hour like this.
Ignoring his bride's advice, Cobb got out of bed with all of the best intentions. He walked right into a trap.
Bukhari. His wife asked him, Where are you going? Cobb replied, Out with Muhammad bin Maslama and my brother Abu. His wife said, I hear evil in his voice, as if his words are dripping blood. Cobb said, They are my brother and my foster brother. A generous man should respond to a call at night, even if invited to be killed.
Islam is so corrosive. Muslims think nothing of murdering their kin. Under the cover of darkness,
Muslim. Muhammad said to his companions, As he comes down, I will extend my hands toward his head. I will touch his hair and smell it. When you see that I have got a hold of his head, strip him. When I hold him fast, you do your job. Cobb bin Ashraf came down wrapped in his clothes. Tabari. He spoke with them for a while. Then they said, Would you like to walk with us, Cobb, so that we can talk? Bukhari. Muhammad said, I have never smelt a better perfume than this, so that Cobb would relax his guard. Will you allow me to smell your head? Then Abu thrust his hand into the hair near his temple. When Muhammad got a strong hold of him, he said, Strike the enemy of Allah. So they smote him. Ishaq. Their swords rained blows upon him, but to no avail. Muhammad bin Maslama said, When I saw that they were ineffective, I remembered a long, thin dagger which I had in my scabbard. I took hold of it. By this time, the enemy of Allah had shouted so loudly, lamps had been lit in the homes around us. I plunged the dagger into his breast and pressed upon it so heavily that it reached his pubic region. Allah's enemy fell to the ground.
But dead was not enough.
Tabari and Ishaq. We carried Cobb's head and brought it to Muhammad during the night. We saluted him as he stood praying and told that we had slain Allah's enemy. When he came out to us, we cast Ashraf's head before his feet. The prophet praised Allah that the poet had been assassinated and complimented us on the good work we had done in Allah's cause. Then he spat upon our comrade's wound
in occult fashion,
and we returned to our families. Our attack on Allah's enemy cast terror among the Jews, and there was no Jew in Medina who did not fear for his life.
The last line is especially repugnant. It is not enough to murder Jews. Muslims must terrorize them as well. The assassins recited these lines.
Ishaq, Cobb's body was left prostrate,
humiliated in submission.
After his fall, all of the Nadir Jews were brought low. Sword in hand, we cut him down. By Muhammad's order, we were sent secretly by night, brother killing brother. We lured him to his death with guile.
Guile is cunning, craftiness, and deviousness.
Traveling by night, bold as lions, we went into his home. We made him taste death with our deadly swords. We sought victory for the religion of the Prophet.
The guile of Islam is so evil, it takes your breath away. Only two men in human history have spoken and then implemented the words you are going to hear next, dear Fuhrer and dear Prophet.
Tabari and Ishaq. The next morning the Jews were in a state of fear on account of our attack on the enemy of Allah. After the assassination, the Prophet declared, "Kill every Jew."
It's hard to imagine the lone prophet of a billion people uttering such words, but recognizing he did may serve to save us from the men
his religion
has poisoned. Exposing Muhammad is the surest way to protect the world from his legacy. Along these lines, we find another blunt reminder of Islam's violent hatred.
Bukhari, just issue orders to kill every Jew in the country. Tabari and Ishaq, thereupon Masud leapt upon Sunaya, one of the Jewish merchants, with whom his family had social and commercial relations, and killed him. The Muslim's brother complained, saying, "Why did you kill him? You have much fat in your belly from his charity." Masud answered, "By Allah, had Muhammad ordered me to murder you, my brother, I would have cut off your head." Wherein the brother said, "Any religion that can bring you to this is indeed wonderful." And he accepted Islam.
Over the course of these pages, we have progressed from silly creation accounts to devilish encounters with rascally spirits, from laughable corruptions of biblical stories to lustful renditions of a perverse paradise. But we have left all of that now. Muhammad has been empowered to implement Islam, and his method of choice is murder. Yet there is something far more sinister lurking behind every word. Throughout the Islamic depiction of these hell-bent activities, Team Islam consistently championed behavior we would expect from Satan. The gospel of the Messiah, this is not. I realize that Muhammad's demonic nature has become oppressive. So I'm going to switch gears to see what Allah has to say for himself. Five relatively short surahs were revealed during this hellish time. Let's begin by reviewing the passages I previously omitted from
The Confrontation.
By way of introduction, in the first six verses, Allah confessed to being a terrorist and pirate. He claimed responsibility for exiling the Jews, and he gave his apostle the booty. Then, in the eighth verse, Allah played favorites. The immigrants were preferred over the Ansar. Having been Muslims longer, they were better terrorists.
Quran 59, verse 8. The spoils are for the immigrants who were expelled from their homes and from their belongings while seeking the bounty of Allah and aiding his messenger. Such are the sincere ones. They are loyal.
Mercenaries are motivated by money. When it comes to killers, you get what you pay for. Whether in business or piracy, war or terror, the principle holds true today. In this light, suicide bombings are not sacrifices, simply selfish acts. The bomber is expecting dual rewards. His family will be enriched monetarily, and he will be given a lifetime pass into Allah's brothel. The first Muslim militants didn't rob Jews and Arabs for Islam. They did it for the money. When you come to understand the nature of the relationship between warlord and mercenary, all of Islam becomes clear. Muhammad was ensnared by the monster he had created. He lured disgruntled and covetous thugs into his lair by promising booty. Terror became a job, one that required ever more revenue. Mercenaries sell their souls for money. It's as simple as that. The most loyal killers are the highest paid and the most corrupt. But when revenues run dry, as they did when the militants missed the merchants at Badar and were forced to fight, the warlord becomes desperate. A poor tyrant is a dead one. So the Jews were robbed in lieu of the caravan. The most loyal mercenaries received the lion's share. Hitler played the same game, as do all dictators. The only difference is that with early Islam, the justification was attributed to God. And that is what makes Islam more lethal than any other doctrine. Reminding us that a peaceful Muslim is a hypocrite, Allah says that they are no better than the Jews.
Quran 59 verse 11. Have you not observed the hypocrites, saying to you, their unbelieving brethren among the people of the book, if you are expelled
from your homes by the Muslims,
will we go with you? We will never listen to anyone who acts to harm you. And if you are attacked, we will help you. But Allah is witnessing that they are liars. If the Jews are expelled, never will the hypocrites go with them. If they are attacked, they will not help them defend themselves. In truth, you,
good jihadist Muslims,
are more fearful and awful than they, because they are afraid of you. This is a result of the terror sent by Allah. They are men devoid of understanding.
Good Muslims are to be feared. They are awful terrorists. Their scripture says so. Occasionally I find myself checking the cover of the book just to make sure I haven't replaced the Quran with Mein Kampf.
Quran 59 verse 14. The Jews will not unite and fight against you except from behind walls. They hate themselves. You would think they were united, but their hearts are divided. That is because these
Jews
are a people devoid of sense, like those who recently preceded them,
the Meccans at Badar.
They,
the Jews who were just sent into the desert to die,
have tasted the evil result of their conduct, and in the hereafter there is for them a grievous punishment.
Replace ghettos with townships, poles for Meccans, and the evil result of exile with a concentration camp. And this surah could easily have been one of Hitler's rousing recitals. Makes you wonder if they had the same speechwriter. This next verse perplexed me until I came to know the nature of the spirit named Halal bin Shakar and his derogatory title, Satan.
Quran 59 verse 16. They,
the Jews,
are like Satan when he tells a man not to believe. When man denies, Satan says, I have nothing to do with you. I fear Allah, the Lord of men and jinn.
Well, it's fascinating that Satan
fears Allah
and sees him as the
Lord.
This isn't the most important insight.
Quran 59:17. Both
Jews and Satan
will go into the fire of hell, dwelling therein forever. Such is the reward of the Zalimun, the disbelievers and polytheists.
At first blush, this was a house divided. We have seen time and again that the only spirit dark enough to have inspired Islam is Satan. But this verse condemns Satan to hell. How is that possible, if they are one in the same? For the answer to that question, let's turn to the book that introduced the world to this demonic spirit. The name that is transliterated from Latin as Lucifer is only mentioned twice in the entire Bible. In the midst of his prophecy on World War III, the all-Islamic war to be launched against Israel in the last days, Isaiah says this about Islam and its dark spirit. The rule of the oppressor, which is from Nagras, one who uses tyranny to harass, tax, and oppress, in other words, Islam, will come to an end. Those who smote, which is from Naka, meaning to strike, exile, murder, punish, or slaughter, the Jews in rage and anger with unceasing blows, and in fury subdued, terrorized, the nations with relentless aggression, will be persecuted. Hell itself will be moved. The pompous, gloating leaders, arrogantly swelling with pride and boastful speech, will be brought from their graves like maggots spread out. How have you fallen, cast out of heaven, O Halal bin Shakar? You have been cast down to the earth and diminished. You use prostration to weaken the Gentile nations. You boasted, I will ascend to heaven. I will exalt my throne above God. I will abide in the meeting place of the most sacred mount, Moriah, home of Satan's most flamboyant shrine, the Dome of the Rock. You said, I will make myself like the Most High, but you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. The offspring of the wicked will not rise up to inherit the land, that being Israel, or rule over the earth. This is Isaiah 14, amplified from the original Hebrew. The prophet Isaiah connected many of the dots for us. He reveals that Satan was a fallen angel, and that pride led to his ruin. He is destructive, leading men to their doom, and he wants to be worshipped in place of Yahweh. Further, he connects Satan to Islam by saying that he is the inspiration of those who oppress the Jews and who covet their land. The fact he uses prostration to weaken the Gentile nations is quite a clue. Satan is Halal bin Shakar's title. Halal means the arrogant one, the one who is deceitful. Shakar is the rising sun. Satan simply means the adversary. John speaks of him in Revelation when he writes, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit, and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil, Satanos, Satan, the adversary. He bound him for 1,000 years. He shut him up so that he could no longer deceive the nations. This is Revelation 20. Satan is a derogatory title for Halal bin Shakar, a spirit who deceives and leads men astray. It means the adversary. Halal bin Shakar, of course, detests the adversary title, as he wants to be God, not God's opponent. Adverse means unfavorable, unpleasant, poor, and undesirable. It is not the kind of image a spirit who wants to be worshipped would be fond of having hung around his neck. Understanding Halal bin Shakar and his disdain for the adversary or satanic title is central to understanding the spirit that underlies Islam, the spirit that enticed and inspired Muhammad to such egregious behavior. Paul, speaking to the Corinthians of the false doctrine and prophet to come, said, I am concerned that just as Chaba, who we mistransliterate as Eve, was deceived and beguiled by the serpent's cunning, your minds may some day be corrupted. For if someone comes and preaches another Yeshua, who is different, if you receive another spirit, or hear a different message of good news, you may be susceptible. I may not possess eloquent speech, or be an apostle who requires your obedience, but I know what is true, and have manifested to you. The truth of the Messiah is in me, and I will continue doing this in order to cut the ground from under those who would seize the opportunity to boast about. For such men are false prophets, deceitful teachers, masquerading as messengers of God. And no wonder, for Satanas, the adversary, transfigures himself and disguises himself into an angel of light. In other words, Halal bin Shakar pretends to be Gabriel. This is from 2 Corinthians chapter 11, amplified from the original Greek. Paul is saying that Satan will transform himself into the image of an angel and deceive men using a false prophet. The messenger will be boastful, yet speak eloquently. He will be deceitful, yet require obedience. He will come with a new message, a new gospel. He is speaking of Muhammad and his Quran. By putting these things together, we discover that Halal bin Shakar, as presented in Scripture, is the perfect match for Allah, the demented and deceitful spirit of the Quran. And we know that Satan hates the adversary title. So now, the only pieces of the puzzle that remain are why Lucifer chose to disguise himself as Gabriel and why he chose Muhammad to be his prophet. The Hebrew word for angel means messenger, and the angel named Gabriel was only called to deliver three messages. The first is to Daniel. He told the prophet the exact day the Messiah would enter Jerusalem, 500 years in advance of the occasion. He spoke of the destruction of the temple, which follows the Messiah's crucifixion and resurrection. Then Gabriel told Daniel that Satan would cause great devastation, and that he would defile Mount Moriah in the last days. The second and then third time we hear from Gabriel is the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke. Gabriel relays a message heralding the birth of John the Baptist, the one who announced the Messiah's arrival. And he told Mary that she would give birth to Yeshua, the son of Yahweh. In other words, Gabriel had only one job, announce the arrival of the Messiah. Satan chose to impersonate him because his Muhammad was the counterfeit Messiah. So now, we know who the players are and why they are acting so devilishly. Returning to the Quran, we find that even mountains fear Allah.
Quran 59, verse 21. Had we sent down this Quran on a mountain, verily you would have seen it humble itself, turn desolate and cleave asunder, splitting in two for fear of Allah. Such are these parables which we propound to men, that they may reflect.
The
confrontation
ends with a self-indulgent love fest. Since the Quran is supposed to be Allah speaking, he sure seems to have a lofty view of himself. It's no wonder pride was Satan's undoing.
Quran 59:22. Allah is He, no other Illah may be worshipped. Who knows best, both secret and open, He most gracious, most merciful. He is Allah, whom there is no other Illah. The Sovereign, the Holy One, the Source of Security, the Guardian of Faith, the Majestic, the Irresistible, the Superb, the Compeller, glory to Allah. He is Allah, the Creator, the Evolver, the Bestower of Forms or Colors. To Him belong the best names. Whatever is in the heavens and on the earth declares His praises and glory. And He is the Mighty, the Wise.
Pretty flowery language for a demon impersonating a rock idol. And it's a wholly deceptive, even beguiling description of the author of the opening salvo of this very surah. As I recall, Allah confessed to being a racist, terrorist thief. In fact, he was proud of it. Moving on, we find that the 61st surah is equally violent and delusional. Its opening salvo blasts away at the prophet's favorite subject, fighting.
Quran 61, verse 2. O Muslims, why say one thing and do another? Grievously odious and hateful is it in the sight of Allah that you say that which you do not. Truly Allah loves those who fight in His cause in battle array, as if they were a solid cemented structure.
While that might explain why there are so many concrete statues of Saddam Hussein,
Allah, loving those who fight,
destroys the myth that Islam is a religion. Coveting that which is Yahweh's, Allah claimed that Moses was really Muhammad, practicing Islam in an earlier life.
Quran 61 verse 5. And remember, Moses said, O my people, why do you annoy and insult me, when you know well that I am Allah's messenger? Then, when they turned away, Allah caused them to be deceived.
According to Allah, even Yeshua was converted to Islam.
Quran 61 verse 6. And Isa, or Jesus, the son of Mary, said, Children of Israel, I am the messenger of Allah, sent to you, confirming that which was revealed before me in the Torah, and giving glad tidings of a messenger to come after me, whose name shall be Ahmad, the praised one. But when he came to them with clear signs, they said, This is sorcery.
Search as I might, I can't find this in my Bible. But it sure makes Paul's warning ring true.
Quran 61 verse 7. Who does greater wrong than one who invents falsehood against Allah, even as he is being summoned to Islam? And Allah guides not the disbelievers. Their intention is to extinguish Allah's light by blowing with their mouths. But Allah will complete his light, even though the unbelievers detest it. It is he who has sent his messenger with guidance and the religion of truth, or Islam, that he may make it conquer all religion, even though the disbelievers hate it.
The phrase,
conquer all religion,
should be a fair warning to the ecumenical movement, those who say all faiths present different paths to the same God, and should therefore be approached with respect and tolerance. Further, in light of what we just read in Isaiah, this pronouncement is a dead ringer for Satan. It's time to make a deal. Sell your soul to this devil, and he will escort you into the gardens of delight.
Quran 61 verse 10. Believers, shall I lead you to a bargain or trade that will save you from a painful torment? That you believe in Allah and his messenger, Muhammad, and that you strive and fight in the cause of Allah with your property and your lives, that will be best for you, if you but knew.
Since Allah's cause is defined as fighting, or jihad, this is a call to martyrdom. It's the anthem of suicide bombers.
Quran 61:12. He will forgive you your sins and admit you to gardens under which rivers flow and to beautiful mansions in Eden. That is indeed the supreme achievement and another favor which you love, help from Allah for a speedy victory over your enemies.
Yes, Muslims love a speedy victory. Time is money.
Quran 61:14. O Muslims, be helpers of Allah, as Jesus or Isa, the son of Mary, said to the disciples, Who will be my helpers in the cause of Allah? Said the disciples, We are Allah's helpers. Then a portion of the children of Israel believed, and a portion disbelieved. But we gave power to those who believed against their enemies, and they became victorious.
Allah is saying, Fight for me, and I will give you the power to kill my enemies. The children of Israel. So that we might know why the Quran was so poorly written, Allah began the 62nd surah proclaiming,
It is he who has sent to the unlettered ones a messenger from among them to rehearse and recite to them his verses, to purify them, and to instruct them in the book and sunnah of Muhammad. They had been in manifest error.
The Quran is an illiterate rehearsing scriptures to the unlettered. Perfect. This next is vintage Muhammad. It's proof that he and his wannabe god were racist.
Quran 62 verse 5. The likeness of those who are entrusted with the Torah, who subsequently failed in those obligations, is that of an ass which carries huge books but understands them not. Wretched is the likeness of folk who deny the verses of Allah, and Allah guides not disbelievers.
Allah just had his illiterate prophet call the literate Jews asses for carrying books that they did not understand. Astonishing. And not that it's important, but there's a contradiction. Earlier, Allah said the Jews were swines and monkeys, not asses. For a book so dependent upon the Jews and their scripture, Allah and his unlettered pal don't seem to like them very much.
Quran 62, verse 6. Say, you Jews, if you think that you are friends of Allah to the exclusion of other men, then desire death if you are truthful. But never will they long for death because of what their hands have done before them. Allah knows well the polytheists. Say, the death from which you flee will truly overtake you. Then you will be sent back to the knower of things secret and open, and he will tell you the things that you did.
How's that for a bottom line? Desire death if you are truthful. Now that Allah has helped his prophet condemn Jews, it's time to turn on the bad Muslims, those nasty hypocrites. In a surah named in their honor, we read,
Quran 63, verse 1. When the hypocrites come to you, they say, we bear witness that you are indeed the messenger of Allah. Allah knows that you are his messenger, and Allah bears witness the hypocrites are indeed liars.
Which means they were liars when they
bore witness that Muhammad was the messenger of Allah. Quran 63, verse 2. They have made their oaths a screen. They obstruct men from the path of Allah. Truly evil are their deeds. That is because they believed, then they rejected faith. So a seal was set on their hearts. Therefore they understand not.
I'm curious. If Muhammad was so wonderful, how could so many of those who lived in his presence have rejected him and his religion? This avalanche of abandonment was obviously the reason Muhammad had to tell his militants in Bukhari,
if a Muslim discards his faith, kill him.
Islam must be forced on people. No one in their right mind chooses it. And once again, no one leaves this cult alive.
Quran 63, verse 4. When you look at them, their bodies please you, and when they speak, you listen to their words. They are pieces of wood propped up. They think every cry is against them. They are the enemies. So beware of them. The curse of Allah is on them. Allah will destroy them. How they are deluded and perverted.
Since Allah repeatedly defines bad Muslim hypocrites as those unwilling to leave their homes to fight, peaceful Muslims ought to know that their God has cursed them, and that they are his enemy, and that he wants to destroy them because they are perverted. So how does all of this square with predestination?
Quran 63, 6. It is equal to them whether you ask forgiveness or not. Allah will never forgive them. Allah does not forgive the transgressing people.
Then whom, might I ask, does he forgive? Perfect people like Muhammad? Think about the absurdity of this statement. Only transgressors need forgiveness, yet they will receive none. So only those who don't need to be forgiven will be forgiven for that which they don't need to be forgiven for. No one is going to accuse Allah of being smart. The Quran suggests that Muhammad and his Meccan immigrants had overstayed their welcome.
Quran 63, verse 7. They are the ones who say, spend nothing on those who are with Allah's messenger, so that they will desert him. But to Allah belongs the treasures of the earth. But the hypocrites understand not. They say, if we return to Medina, surely the most honorable element will expel the meaner, that is, Muhammad. But honor, power, and glory belong to Allah and his messenger.
It's interesting that the first Muslims considered Muhammad mean. They also recognized that his parasites or mercenaries were only hanging around for the money. And why, if the treasures of the earth belonged to Allah, did Abu Bakr prowl the streets begging Jews to give Allah a good loan? Since the established families of Yathrib were unwilling to finance the Prophet's piracy, Allah repeatedly ordered Muslims to pay the zakat, a tax of which Muhammad was the beneficiary.
Quran 63, verse 10. Spend out of the substance.
In other words, booty.
which we gave you before death comes, and you say, My Lord, why didn't you give me respite for a little while? I wish I had given more.
Financing the Prophet's terrorist campaigns was now on Allah's list of good deeds. The noble Quran footnotes a Bukhari hadith to explain this verse.
The Prophet said, Every day two angels come down from heaven. One says, O Allah, reward every person who spends in your cause. The other says, O Allah, destroy every miser.
Moving on to the 64th surah, we discover that the Prophet is losing believers in droves. He remains fixated on those who are rejecting Islam.
Quran 64 verse 5. Has not the story reached you of those who disbelieved before? They taste the ill effects of their unbelief. They tasted a painful torment, because there came to them messengers with clear proofs, but they said, Shall mere human beings direct us? So they rejected and turned away. But Allah can do without them. Allah is rich, the owner of praise. Those who reject faith and treat our signs as falsehoods, they will be the companions of the fire, to dwell therein forever, an evil resort.
If Allah is indeed Satan, he can't do without man. He needs men to do his bidding. The following verse establishes Allah as the Lord of disasters, pain and suffering, of disease, failure, and heartache.
Quran 64:11. No calamity occurs, no affliction comes, except by the decision and preordainment of Allah. Verse 12. So obey Allah and obey His messenger, Muhammad. But if you turn back, the duty of our messenger devolves only to convey, Allah, there is no illah but He.
Returning to the hypocrites, we are told that they are lurking everywhere.
Quran 64, verse 14. Believers, truly among your wives and your children there are enemies for you. So beware of them. Your wealth and your children are only a trial.
Islam is twisted and inverted. Wives and children are a blessing, not enemies. A joy, not a trial. Ever eager to fleece his flock, the Prophet recited,
Quran 64, verse 16, Fear Allah as much as you can. Listen and obey. Pay the zakat. Those, saved from covetousness, prosper. If you loan to Allah a beautiful loan, He will double it. He will grant forgiveness, for Allah is most ready to appreciate.
Just think of what this guy could have done with cable TV. Step right up and buy your forgiveness here. Against this backdrop of money-grubbing scriptures, the terrorist raids continued.
Tabari, the messenger ordered Zayed,
the Prophet's former slave termed adoptive son,
out on a raid in which he captured a Quraysh caravan led by Abu Sufyan at a watering place in Najd,
proving that they were civilian businessmen and thus a terrorist target.
A number of their merchants set out with a large amount of silver, since this was the main part of their merchandise. They hired a man to guide them along this route. Zayed captured the caravan and its goods, but was unable to capture the men. He brought the caravan to the Prophet.
If this isn't piracy and terror, the words need to be redefined.
Tabari, the reason for this expedition was that the Quraysh said, Muhammad has damaged our trade and sits astride our road. If we stay in Mecca, we'll consume our capital. The news of the caravan reached the Prophet, as did the information that it contained much wealth and silver vessels. Zayed therefore intercepted it and made himself master of their caravan. The fifth, or Qums, was 20,000 dirhams. Allah's apostle took it and divided the other four-fifths among the members of the raiding party. Furat was taken captive. They said to him, If you accept Islam, the messenger will not kill you.
Submit or die has been the modus operandi of Islam ever since. It is a most interesting form of evangelism. Another terrorist raid under their belts. It was time for murder.
The Killing of Abu Rafi the Jew
is the very next hadith.
Tabari. In this year, it is said, the killing of Abu Rafi the Jew took place. The reason for his being killed was, it is said, that he used to take the part of Ka'b bin Ashraf against the messenger. The Prophet is said to have sent Abdallah bin Atiq against him in the middle of Jumada, or November of 624.
Muhammad had a rougher time controlling the media than do today's terrorists. Now Muslims just lie, and the press laps it up. There aren't five journalists in the entire free world with the will and wisdom to expose Islam.
The messenger sent some Ansar under the command of Abu Allah and Abd Allah against Rafi the Jew. Abu Rafi used to injure and wrong the Prophet. Bukhari. One of them sent out and entered their fort. He said, I hid myself in a stable for their animals. They closed the gate. Later, they lost a donkey. I went out with them, pretending to look for it. They found the donkey and went home. I went with them.
Tabari provides us with a slightly different twist, one more in keeping with today's jihadists.
Abdallah said to the others, Stay where you are, and I will go and ingratiate myself with the doorkeeper to gain entrance. When he was close, he wrapped himself in his cloak as though he were relieving himself. The doorkeeper called, You there! If you want to come in, come now, because I want to shut the gate. I went in and hid myself in the donkey pen.
Returning to Bukhari,
they closed the gate at night and kept its keys in a small window where I could see them. When the people slept, I took the keys and opened the door. Abu Rafi had company that night, but when they left, I went to him.
Revealing the reason that Islam must be exposed, Tabari reports,
Every time I opened a door, I shut it behind me from the inside, saying to myself, If they become aware, they will not have time to stop me from killing him. When I reached Rafi, he was in a dark room with his family. I did not know where he was in the room. I said, Oh, Abu Rafi! When he replied, I proceeded toward the voice and gave him a blow with my sword. He shouted, and I came back, pretending to be a helper. I said, Oh, Abu, changing the tone of my voice. He asked me, I don't know who came to strike me with his sword. Then I drove my sword into his belly, and I pushed it forcibly down till it touched the bone. I hit him again and covered him with wounds, but I could not kill him, so I thrust the point of my sword into his stomach until it came out through his back. At that, I knew I had killed him.
In front of his wife and children.
I came out, filled with puzzlement, and I went toward a ladder in order to get down, but I fell into a moonlit night and sprained my foot. I bound it with my turban and moved on. I came to my companions and said, By Allah, I will not leave until I hear the wailing of their women. So I did not move till I heard them crying for the Jewish merchant. I said, Deliverance! Allah has killed Abu Rafi! I got up, feeling no ailment, and proceeded till we came upon the Prophet and informed him.
Each time Muslims kill, they absolve themselves of the crime by blaming their God. While calling Allah an assassin seems odd, it proves my theory. Allah needs men to do his bidding. Satan is helpless without stooges. And lest we forget, Muhammad had now become a serial killer. Usually, such men are condemned, locked up, and repudiated. This one was followed. The next hadith turns murder into a contest.
Tabari, Abu Rafi was one of those who had mustered azab against the Prophet. The Oz had killed Ka'b Ashraf on account of his enmity to the messenger and his inciting people against him. So the Khazraj asked the Prophet for permission to kill Salam Hukaik, who was in Khaybar. He granted this.
The Ansar were comprised of Oz and Khazraj. They were vying for the Prophet's attention by killing Jewish poets. It was an ungodly game.
Tabari and Ishaq. One of the favors which Allah conferred upon his Prophet was that these two tribes of the Ansar, the Oz and the Khazraj, used to vie with one another like stallions to carry out the will of Muhammad. The Oz did nothing which benefited him without the Khazraj saying, By Allah, they will not gain superiority over us in Islam in the eyes of the messenger by doing this, and they would not cease until they had done something similar. Thus, when the Awas killed Kab Ashraf on account of his hostility to Muhammad, the Khazraj conferred to find a man comparable to Kab in hostility, and called to mind Salam Hukaik in Khaybar. They asked the Prophet for permission to kill him, and it was granted.
Proving once again that the best Muslims are killers. Deception was a hallmark of this assassination, as it had been in the others. So was cowardice.
Tabari and Ishaq. His wife came out, and we told her that we were Arabs in search of supplies. When we entered, we bolted the door on her, so she gave a shout to warn him of our presence. We rushed upon him with our swords as he lay in his bed. He took his pillow and tried to fend us off. Abdallah thrust his sword into his stomach and transfixed him while he was shouting, "Enough! Enough!" At once we went out, but Abdallah had bad eyesight, and he fell off the stairway, bruising his arm or leg. "How shall we know that the enemy of Allah is dead?" one of us asked. "I will go and look," one replied. He set off and mingled with the people. He said, "I found him with the men of the Jews and with his wife, who had a lamp in her hand." Peering into his face, she said, "By the God of the Jews, he is dead. I never heard more pleasing words than these." We went to the messenger of Allah, and I told him that we had killed the enemy of Allah. We disagreed in his presence about the killing of Salam, each of us claiming to have done it. The Prophet said, "Bring me your swords." We did, and he looked at them. He said, "This sword of Abdallah killed him. I can see the marks left by bones on it."
There are no words more pleasing to a Muslim than, "A Jew is dead." The first followers of this perverse doctrine, Muhammad's disciples, had been so corrupted by Islam, they believed they were doing God a service by eliminating Jews. They fought over who should be given credit for the kill. It is why Christ warned his disciples, saying, "A time is coming when everyone who kills you will think he is offering his service to God." John 16:2. To celebrate Salam's murder, Muslim militants sang the following chorus.
Ishaq. Allah, what a fine band you have, one willing to kill Salam and Ashraf. We went with sharp swords like fighting lions. We came upon their homes and made them drink death with our swift slaying swords. Looking for the victory of our Prophet's religion, we ignored every risk.
The religious doctrine of Islam, that caustic blend of politics and religion, was the motivation behind the forced banishment of the Kainuka, a Jewish township larger than Mecca. It enabled Muhammad to instigate the murder of Jewish journalists. It inspired the grotesque slayings of a Jewish merchant. Muhammad, in cahoots with his demonic spirit, lured men into hellish duty with the dual enticements of worldly booty and heavenly lust. Islam corroded minds and corrupted souls beyond salvation. The Islamic economy and governance was based upon piracy and militancy. Muslim mercenaries could no longer distinguish right from wrong, truth from deceit. Their religitech, or politicized religion, created the culture needed to motivate men to madness and murder. It still does. Hopefully, you have not felt the sting of Islamic terror personally. As such, you may be able to compartmentalize the horror of these events. And that's understandable. We do not know how many Kainuka women and children died after being thrown into the desert. We can only imagine how they suffered. And up to this point, Muhammad's militants had slaughtered barely 100 innocent souls. By the close of the second year of the Islamic era, the first Muslim marauders were still small-time tyrants. Close your eyes, set down the book, turn off the audio, and it will all just fade away. Sorry, it won't work that way. We ignore Islam at our peril. Undiagnosed and untreated, evil festers and grows. Like a cancer, it leaves nothing but death and destruction in its wake. Whether you view the world through the prism of the Islamic scriptures, the Bible, or history, the inevitable consequence of our present course will lead to World War III. I believe over 1 billion people will die in the first third of the 21st century as a result of our ignorance and our tolerance of Islam. Biological and nuclear weapons will be unleashed in a war started by Muslims in pursuit of Jews. It will create hell on earth and destroy the world as we know it. The Quran and Hadith serve as proof that Islam is destructive. With every page, this is made abundantly clear. Left to its own devices, it's obvious where Islam will lead. Muhammad's legacy is terror. From the biblical perspective, the prophecies pertaining to World War III are laid out in the last chapter. So for now, let's focus on the historical justification for my rather dire prediction. To stress the consequence of tolerating Islam, I'm going to share some quotations from the gospel of the 20th century's most famous religious doctrine. This prophet's name was Adolf Hitler. His book was Mein Kampf. His religiotech was Nazism. The consequence was World War II. Even in the tolerant realm of political correctness, Nazism is rebuked. So if I can demonstrate that apart from time and place, Nazism is virtually indistinguishable from Islam, I will have removed the veil of religiosity that protects Islam from scrutiny. Even pacifists understand the consequence of ignoring Hitler. By showing that Mein Kampf and the Quran were authored by the same spirit, and that their motives, missions, and means were indistinguishable, I will have made exposing and rebuking Islam relevant, as Mein Kampf led to the Holocaust and to the brutal death of 55 million people. By proving that Nazism was founded as a religion, as a tool a covetous man used to satiate his personal craving for power, sex, and money, I will have awakened an unquenchable desire to eradicate the religious dogma that inspired it, Islam, before it obliterates all mankind. In that light, I beg your indulgence. Mein Kampf is a 1,000-page rant. I will be revealing passages, edited of verbosity, found in the 1939 English translation I urge you to read, Raynal and Hitchcock, by Houghton Mifflin. We have already reviewed the introduction, one written immediately after the Land for Peace Treaty that severed Czechoslovakia, starting World War II. The translators warned that ignoring the Nazi gospel would have catastrophic consequences. They were right. To discover why they came to that conclusion, and to see why I'm convinced that ignoring the Islamic gospel will lead to World War III, let's dive into the words, world, and mind of Adolf Hitler, and compare them to Mohammed's. Mein Kampf was written from Landsberg-on-the-Lech prison in 1924, precisely 1,300 years after the Kainuka Jews were abused so horrifically in 624 A.D. It was dedicated to 16 martyrs, men Hitler praised as
dead heroes, blood witnesses who continue to serve as brilliant examples for the followers of our movement. They were steadfast in their belief in the resurrection of their people.
The Muslim martyrs at Badr served Muhammad just as aptly. And I'm sure you noticed Hitler's predilection for religious terms. In his opening salvo, he unleashed
witnesses, serve, examples, followers, movement, steadfast, belief, and resurrection.
It wasn't by chance. Although better written and more insightful, the object and style of Mein Kampf is identical to the Quran and Hadith.
Mein Kampf, Preface. I resolve to set forth in 2 volumes the object of our movement and to draw a picture of its development. From this more can be learned than from any purely doctrinary treatise.
Mein Kampf, like the Quran, was written in first person. The Royal Hour, in the preceding quote, was collective, because Hitler saw himself as being spiritually guided. Although much of Mein Kampf was plagiarized, Its formulation and proclamation, like Islam, was the work of a solitary man, one inspired by a dark, deceitful, hateful, and violent spirit. The Quran and Hadith were never meant for non-Muslims to read.
Mein Kampf, Preface. With this work, I do not address myself to strangers, but to those adherents of the movement who belong to it with their hearts and whose reason now seeks a more intimate enlightenment.
Muhammad ordered Muslims not to take the Quran with them when they conquered new lands.
Bukhari. Allah's apostle forbade the people to travel to a hostile country carrying copies of the Quran.
He said,
Unbelievers will never understand our signs and revelations.
Muhammad also claimed that nothing should be written if it could be spoken. He believed that eloquent speech had been the magic that had enabled his destiny. His Quran was, after all, an oral recital. The Hadith remains nothing more than an oral report. Hitler tells us why.
Mein Kampf, Preface. I know that one is able to win people far more by the spoken word than by the written word. Every great movement on this globe owes its rise to great speakers and not to writers.
Muslims and Nazis alike report that men swooned in the founder's presence, as he so passionately called them to his cause. But I must say, in Hitler's defense, he was a much more coherent writer than was Allah. But alas.
Mein Kampf, Preface. Nevertheless, the basic elements of a doctrine must be set down in permanent form in order that it may be represented in the same way and in unity.
In other words, I want my prophetic words to survive me, and that's because both men wanted to outlive those who tormented, mocked, and rejected them.
Mein Kampf, Preface. Mein Kampf will serve to destroy the evil legends created about my person by the Jewish press.
Muhammad and Hitler saw themselves and their followers as a nation in distress, one that could, should, and would righteously steal what belonged to others. Hitler said,
Mein Kampf. The distress of the nation gives us the moral right to acquire foreign soil and territory. The sword is then the plow. From the tears of war, there grows the daily bread for generations to come.
Muhammad said,
Quran 13:41. Do they not see us advancing from all sides into the land of the disbelievers, reducing its borders by giving it to believers in war victories?
Inspiring militants to become plundering pirates, both religiotechs turned their adherents into parasites. Their economies became dependent upon booty. Honest labor was confined to fighting.
Mein Kampf, Preface. That also gave me the opportunity to describe my own development as far as it is necessary to understand these volumes.
The Quran screams out to us today, testifying that Muhammad was an abused child, hating all who withheld the power and wealth he craved. Mein Kampf is more direct. Hitler admits to being abused, to being orphaned, and to being poor. He tells us how this led him to create his new religion, and how he would use it to attack both his powerful peers and the defenseless Jews. As such, reading Mein Kampf is like having a conversation with Muhammad. Hitler and Muhammad rose from tiny towns they ultimately attacked.
Mein Kampf. Today I consider it my good fortune that fate designated the small town of Bernau as the place of my birth.
Der Führer called his guiding spirit fate and nature. Both were always capitalized as if divine, and used interchangeably with Lord and God. These words are found throughout English translations of the Bible and Quran. Both have pagan origins. Lord was the title of Baal, the Canaanite god. The English God is derived from the German Gott. Pagan Aryans coined the term in reference to the dark spirits they worshipped. Satan would be honored with either moniker. Like Muhammad, Hitler was orphaned and abused. He described his youth in these terms.
Mein Kampf, 6. Endless poverty, misery and hardship, want and sorrow. 7. I was a quarrelsome boy. 29. Hunger was my faithful guard, the only friend who never left me. 33. I have felt poverty's grip, a murderous viper with poisonous fangs. 32. The relentless struggle killed all pity. My painful existence suffocated any feeling of sympathy.
Remember these words. Hitler described his torment.
Mein Kampf, 43. I was familiar with nothing but filth and despised all authority. 39. What grew out of this unhappiness and misery, of this filth and decay, was no longer a human being. I possessed a ruthless resolution to destroy the incurable social tumors.
I believe that this is how Mohammed felt as he endured the anguish of poverty and the unrelenting harshness of the Arabian desert. He came to despise all authority except his own. Understanding Hitler's motivation is important because ultimately the two most diabolical doctrines ever conceived by man were the direct result of an abused childhood. A festering rage caused both founders to covet what they were denied and to hate those they viewed as responsible for their torment. Speaking of his abusive father, Hitler said,
Mein Kampf, 14. The old man became embittered. I got the worst of it as he relentlessly began to enforce his authority. 38. He became familiar with alcohol, coming home drunk and brutal. God have mercy on the scenes which followed. I witnessed it all personally, hundreds of times, with disgust and indignation. Even now I shudder when I think of those pitiful times. The pictures are haunting, but fate will take its revenge.
Hitler, like Mohammed, was fatalistic. Der Führer named his guiding spirit Fate, while the prophet usurped every characteristic of Manat, the Arab goddess of fate. Both believed that their god would help them avenge their tormented youth. They preached predestination because it eliminates choice. Being abandoned shaped the boys who would become tyrants.
Mein Kampf, 24. When I was 13, my father died quite suddenly, 25. 2 years later, my mother's death put a sudden end to all my plans. Her illness exhausted our meager funds. The orphan's pension I received was not nearly enough for me to live on. I hoped to wrest from fate some success. I needed to become something.
This was Muhammad's motivation. It resonates throughout the Quran and Hadith. He was insecure and needed to prove that he was somebody. Although his behavior was criminal and immoral, Der Führer, like Der Prophet, saw himself as a bastion of virtue.
Mein Kampf, 41. I was shocked by the ethical and moral crudity of my comrades and by their low level of spiritual development. 41. Not a shred of humanity is left. Not a single institution is unattacked. From teacher to head of state, from religion to morality, everything is abused, pulled down in the nastiest manner into filth and depravity.
Mohammed saw Arabs as either good fighters in his cause, useless hypocrites, or as enemy infidels. Hitler's view was no different.
Mein Kampf, 16. I saw the world in three groups, the fighters, the lukewarm, and the traitors.
Both doctrines were uncompromising, intolerant, born in blood, and propelled by sword. The means to Hitler's madness was his corruption of history and his wanton disregard for facts and chronology. This was identical to Mohammed's dim-witted rape of the Bible.
Mein Kampf, 18. I learned how to forecast the future by recalling the past. The chronology of history does not matter. It is the search for forces which cause effects. Remember that which is important and forget the rest.
The Aryan dictator twisted the past to serve his future, just like the Arab pirate before him.
Mein Kampf, 47. Content is registered in the mind, not according to the sequence it happened or the sequence in which the books were read, but just as small pieces of a mosaic that must be put into place.
While Mohammed wasn't this articulate or philosophical, he did have a penchant for taking unrelated pieces of Jewish history and rearranging them to his liking. Mein Kampf and the Quran were comprised of the same raw material and crafted in the same fashion.
Mein Kampf, 49. As soon as the knowledge is gained, it finds its due place in the picture the imagination has created. It acts as a supplement, enhancing truth and clarity.
Both men use their twisted histories to befuddle their assailants.
Mein Kampf, 49. A public speaker will never convincingly confront a contradiction without such information. A knowledge of history can be used to confound an adversary.
And they use the Bible to make the ungodly sound religious.
Mein Kampf, 51. The more the linguistic tohu wa bohu.
This is Hebrew from Genesis 1-2, meaning chaos and confusion.
Ate into the existing government, the faster they heralded a day of doom for their Babylonian realm.
Muhammad's favorite prediction was of the day of doom, and it was in the Babylonian realm that Islam was molded into a religious doctrine capable of seducing a billion souls. Hitler's next line provides a wonderful insight into the mindset of Muhammad as his demonic spirit welled up inside of him, causing him to chafe at the Hebrew scriptures.
Mein Kampf, 55. An inner voice now urged me on. The effect was like a spiritual vitriol,
which is anger, wrath, fury, rage, and ire.
I had to fight down the rage rising in me. The enemy's wretched papers comprise a concentrated solution of lies.
Hitler said of the Jewish-inspired socialist doctrine he would both emulate and hate.
Mein Kampf, 56. Everything was written with an iron-faced prophetic certainty. Contained in the literature was a doctrine of salvation for a new mankind. Yet they operated in the most base manner with brutal forces of calumny,
which is slander and defamation. The master of propaganda said,
they possess a virtuosity for lying that is outrageous.
Der Führer must have shared Der Prophet's speechwriter. While the populations of Austria and Germany were 10,000 times larger than Mohammed's Mecca, Der Führer despised his rulers as much as Der Prophet disdained his chiefs. The empowered held what these men coveted.
Mein Kampf, 20. I have become an enemy of the ruling dynasty which has so disastrously influenced the state. The imperials have betrayed the cause of the people for their own ignominious ends.
Mein Kampf's never-ending argument rivaled the Quran's.
Mein Kampf, 21. The hypocrisy of the Habsburgs,
which would be Hitler's Quraysh,
fanned the flames of hatred, indignation, and contempt. 42. The rats of political poisoning gnaw away at the masses.
Hitler and Mohammed stole the preponderance of their new religious doctrines from established sources. Hitler borrowed from Islam and then usurped the writing of the Nitschkes and Marx, both funded, interestingly enough, by the Illuminati, a religiotech founded to serve and worship Satan. He was dependent upon Mohammed for his intolerance and terror, Nitschke for his philosophy, Marx for his politics. Yet Der Führer, like his mentor, wasn't into sharing power or praise with anyone, especially a Jew. Mohammed plagiarized the style of Zayed and the stories of Moses. Then, in identical fashion, both demagogues turned on the sources of their inspiration. And, as a not-so-coincidental aside, Yahweh's chosen people, the Jews, played a significant role in both men's revelation and rage. The National Socialist German Workers' Party, better known as Nazis, cloaked themselves in Marxist jargon.
Mein Kampf, 51. When I was young, Marxism, social democracy, and socialism were identical ideas to me. But here, too, the hand of fate opened my eyes to this betrayal of the people. I learned about the Social Democratic Party from a spectator's point of view without having the slightest insight into the meaning of their doctrine. But suddenly I came into contact with their view of life and realized that it was a pestilential whore masked in social virtue. I knew that I must rid the world of her.
Hitler's Reich was more controlling than Lenin's Russia. Labor, production, and all things economic were socialized, making his attack on Marxism as hollow as Mohammed swipes at paganism and Judaism. And in like fashion, Mohammed initially saw no difference between his pagan past, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The Quran says,
we make no distinction between them.
But then, when they wouldn't surrender, Mohammed became enraged. His final surahs proclaim,
wipe the infidels out to the last.
Hitler blamed the Jewish Marx for having turned unions into his personal playground, just as Mohammed attacked the Quraysh for hoarding the Kaaba ink.
Mein Kampf, 52. When I was told to join a union, I refused and was thrown out immediately. At first I was annoyed. I drank my bottle of milk and ate my piece of bread, pondering my miserable fate. It annoyed me extremely. The Marxists were exploiting workers, suppressing the proletariat. The institution raised slaves for the new slave drivers. Religion was a means of doping the people destined for exploitation. It dragged people down into the dirt and filth of the lowest depths.
Nazism, like the religion named submission, was designed to exploit and suppress slaves on behalf of their new master, doping the people by way of religion into submission. As such, both condemnations were hypocritical. The perpetrators were worse than those they were assailing. If I were to compress Islam into a single sentence, it would be,
religion was a means of doping the people destined for exploitation.
The tactics of the three religitechs, Islam, communism, and Nazism, became indistinguishable.
Mein Kampf, 53. I argued till finally one day they,
the Marxist Union,
applied the one means that wins the easiest victory over reason, terror and force. The leaders gave me the choice of either leaving the job or being thrown from the scaffold. I was alone, and resistance seemed hopeless.
This is Islam in its purest form. Terror and force compelled the hopeless to forfeit their money or life. Like Mohammed, Hitler would build his religitech on this formula.
Quran 9, verse 29. Fight those who do not submit to Islam until they pay the tribute tax in abject humility.
While Hitler was trying to condemn Marxism with this next slogan, the line works equally well for the victims of Nazism or Islam.
Mein Kampf, 55. Aware of the terrible working of this poison, only a fool would condemn the victim.
This reminds me of the quote from Renan, the Islamic scholar who wrote, Muslims were the first victims of Islam. Many times I have observed in my travels that fanaticism comes from a small number of dangerous men who maintain others in the practice of this religion by terror. To liberate the Muslim from his religion is the best service that one can render him. The Quran, like Mein Kampf, acknowledges the source of its inspiration.
Mein Kampf, 55. My eyes were opened to the inner causes of social democratic successes. I understood the brutal demand to subscribe, to only read red newspapers, red books, and to exclusively attend red meetings. Marxism was a doctrine of intolerance.
This is no different than the Quran's command for Muslims to shun contact with the Christians and Jews who had provided Muhammad's scripture. Having studied Islam, Hitler explained the strategy that propelled Muhammad's rise.
Mein Kampf, 56. Like women, men will submit to a strong man. They are far more satisfied with a doctrine which tolerates no rival. With freedom, men feel at a loss as what to do with it. They feel deserted, spiritually terrorized. They will not recognize the outrageous curtailment of their human liberties, for in no way does the delusion of an intolerant doctrine dawn on them. They see force, brutality, and the aim of the doctrine to which they finally and always submit.
Once again, we see that Islam and Nazism are cut from the same cloth. Force and brutality are the tools of submission. Terror and the outrageous curtailment of human liberties lie at the heart of both doctrines. Neither tolerates a rival.
Quran 8, verse 39. Fight them until all religion is for Allah alone.
The tyrant's methods were identical, as were their means.
Mein Kampf, 56. If social democracy,
Marxism,
is confronted by a doctrine of greater truthfulness, carried out with the same brutality, then the latter will be victorious.
Truth is not relative. Thus, greater truth only means, my way is better, for me, than yours. This statement, which coincides entirely with Islam, means that the tyrant's way will be imposed on any conflicting doctrine by brutal force. Since Nazism wasn't greater truth, it failed, but it took 55 million souls down with it. And since Islam isn't greater truth either, it will also fail, but the price will be higher still.
Bukhari, our Prophet ordered us to fight you until you worship Allah alone or pay us the jizya tax in submission. Our Prophet informed us that our Lord says, whoever amongst us is killed as a martyr shall go to paradise to lead a luxurious life, and whoever survives shall become your master.
Speaking of the socialist doctrine he emulated, Hitler announced that he would do what Mohammed did.
Mein Kampf, 56. The technical tools of social democracy became clear to me. I understood the infamous mental terror which this movement exercised on the population, which could neither morally nor physically resist such attacks. There was a bombardment of lies and calumnies toward the adversary who seemed most dangerous, till finally the nerves of those who had been attacked gave out, and they, for the sake of peace, bowed down to the hated enemy. But these fools did not find peace after all.
Unless I'm mistaken, this sounds similar.
Ishak, Muhammad besieged them for 25 nights. When the siege became too severe for them, Allah terrorized them. Then they were told to submit to the judgment of Allah's messenger. Bukhari, they surrendered to the Prophet. I give my judgment that their men should be killed, their women and children should be taken as captives, and their properties distributed.
Muhammad, Hitler, Lenin, and Mao, religious prophets all, deployed the same tactics to suppress their people and terrorize the world. Mein Kampf foreshadows the future that awaits those who tolerate evil, for those who seek peace with terrorists.
Mein Kampf, 57. The play begins again, and is so often repeated the fear of the mad dog paralyzes suggestion. The social democrat knows from his own experience the value of strength. The doctrine praises every pacifist. Marxism is only afraid of strength.
Hitler knew that tyrannical regimes thrived on ignorance.
Mein Kampf, 57. Most of all, it recommends those who are weaklings in mind and power. Social democracy knows how to create the appearance that it is the only way in which peace can be maintained, yet relentlessly it conquers.
Today, those who promote peace with Islam simply facilitate their conquests. Hitler, as we shall see, linked Judaism to Marxism. With that in mind, consider these prophetic words.
Mein Kampf, 58. These
terror
tactics are based on an exact calculation of all human weaknesses. They will lead to success with mathematical certainty unless the other side learns to fight poison gas with poison gas.
As with Muhammad and Islam, terror was the central ingredient in Hitler's Nazi religiotech.
Mein Kampf, 58. The importance of physical terror against the individual and the masses also became clear to me.
Muhammad agreed.
Bukhari, Allah's apostle said, I have been sent with the shortest expressions bearing the widest meaning, and I have been made victorious with terror.
Der Führer emulated his mentor.
Mein Kampf, 58. Here, too, we find exact calculations of the psychological effect. Terror in the workplace and in the mass demonstration will always be accompanied by success, as long as it is not met by an equally great force of terror.
I find it stunning that America sent emissaries to work with this man throughout the 1930s. I find it stunning that Great Britain capitulated to his will. It's as if they never read his manifesto. It's as if they were ignorant of his motive and means. Yet it's directly analogous to Americans negotiating with Saudis, Egyptians, Iranians, and the so-called Palestinians without having read the Quran or Hadith. 75 years ago, America's best and brightest ignored the words on these pages. In fact, they denied them, as did the nation's media. And this allowed a demented, violent, and hateful religious cancer to fester. Rather than expose and eliminate it when it was weak, we allowed it to garner money, arms, and men. Nazis used them to kill us. And while that's inexcusable, there is something far more disturbing, immoral, and foreboding here. We're doing it all over again. We are just 58 pages into Mein Kampf, and yet we know what Hitler's going to do, and how he's going to do it. You wouldn't think that it would have been too much to ask our leaders to have just read 58 pages, and thereby save the lives of 55 million people. Yet they didn't, and he lashed out as promised. And this is not just a lesson in comparative history, Nazism to Islam. For our leaders haven't cracked the covers of the terrorist manifesto that is motivating killers today. I can only hope and pray that this comparison between Hitler and Mohammed, Mein Kampf and the Quran, will awaken free peoples before terror succeeds once again. Some may protest that Hitler was more ruthless, and thus a comparison is unfair. But one man's comparative success was merely a function of time and place, not nocturnal depravity. With swords and spears rather than tanks and planes, Mohammed was forced to be considerably more deliberate and homespun in his application of terror. Working with freedom-loving and peaceful Arabs rather than disciplined and warlike Aryans, early Islam was a less efficient killer. Without the population density of Europe in the 20th century, the first Muslim militants were less murderous as well. But transfer $1 billion a day to the Islamic cause, give them time to develop nuclear and biological weapons, and time to indoctrinate millions of martyrs to use them, and see what happens in a world of 6 billion souls. The Bible says that a quarter of the earth's population will die in the ensuing war, a third of the planet's surface will be scorched, and pestilence will render even more uninhabitable. Knowing what you know now, do you want to bet against it? Risk your freedom and your life on the off chance that Muslims will not act like Muhammad? Der Prophet identified Jews with plagues.
Bukhari, Allah's apostle said, plague is a means of torture sent on the Israelis.
Hitler wrote of the terror he wished to impose on Marxists, who, like the Jews, were both his inspiration and his rival.
Mein Kampf, 58. Then, of course, the Marxists will cry havoc, scornful of the state,
for not protecting them.
With the resulting disorder, they will reach their goal of finding some idiot official who, in the stupid hope of gaining something for himself, a favor from the dreaded enemy, will help break the adversary of this dreaded plague.
Hitler is implying that confronted with a terrorist doctrine like Islam, a nation like America is likely to comfort the terrorists and attack those with the courage to thwart them. He's right. Just as Muhammad taught his militants to attack infidels, Hitler said,
Mein Kampf, 58. Only those who know the soul of a people, not from books, but from life,
his abused youth,
can understand the impression such success,
terrorism in this case,
makes on the sensibilities of adherents and adversaries. In the ranks of their adherents, the victory gained is looked upon as a triumph of the righteousness of the cause, while the beaten adversary despairs entirely, viewing all further resistance futile.
As we have discovered in the Hadith and Quran, the terrorist raids perpetrated by militants against merchants and by Muslims against Jews had this very effect on both ally and adversary.
Quran 33, verse 22. When the faithful saw the retreating allied armies, this enhanced their faith and obedience. Allah drove the infidels back in their fury so that their resistance was futile.
Mein Kampf, 59. The more I became acquainted with the methods of physical terror, the more I asked forgiveness from the hundreds of thousands who succumbed to it.
They say that confession is good for the soul. Of course, you need to have one for it to work. Muhammad didn't, so he said,
in Quran 8:12, I shall terrorize the infidels, so wound their bodies and incapacitate them because they oppose Allah and His Apostle. Quran 8:57, if you gain mastery over them in battle, inflict such a defeat as would terrorize them, so they would learn a lesson and be warned.
Then speaking of the abuse that gave rise to Islam and Nazism, Der Führer proclaimed,
Mein Kampf, 59. I owe
my inspiration
to that period of suffering because I learned to distinguish between victims and seducers.
Like Muhammad, Hitler, having been a victim, became a seducer so that he might victimize. Both tyrants personified evil, yet in their twisted minds it was their enemies who
sowed the seeds of hatred, creating the justification for their actions. Fate gave me these lessons. 62. The battle against them has to be fought with weapons to have any hope of success. The struggle for the abolition of evil will be decided in favor of the stronger force.
The Prophet loved weapons too.
Quran 8:59. The infidels should not think that they can get away from us. prepare against them whatever arms and weaponry you can muster, so that you may terrorize them. They are your enemy and Allah's enemy."
Both justified their actions by redefining good and evil. Fighting was good. Pacifists were evil. Anything that served to satiate their cravings for power, sex, and money was good. Anything that precluded them from taking these things was bad. This next line explains how Muhammad enticed his mercenaries, building an economy based upon piracy and plunder. It's why everyone in Islam's path ultimately submitted.
Mein Kampf, 63. In politics, the application of economic means of pressure permits extortion so long as the doctrine is reckless and the people are stupid and sheepish.
Muhammad promoted similarly reckless odds by inferring that all non-Muslims were stupid.
Quran 8, verse 65. O Prophet, urge the believers to fight. If there are 20 among you with determination, they will vanquish 200. If 100, they will slaughter 1,000 infidels. For these are a people devoid of understanding.
Mein Kampf, 64. So great was the fear
of terror
that people dreaded war, so the doctrine can ratchet up demands higher and higher. It's a devilish attempt to weaken and paralyze the victim's holiest claims. Considering the limited thinking power of the masses, the success of this strategy is not surprising.
This is precisely what we've been reading about. The first Muslims used terror to paralyze anyone within their reach.
Quran 59, verse 2. It was Allah who drove the people from their homes and into exile. They refused to believe. You did not think that they would go away, and they imagined that their strongholds would protect them. But Allah came at them from where they did not suspect and terrorized them. Their homes were destroyed. So learn a lesson. This is my warning.
Hitler said this of communism, but it is equally true of Islam.
Mein Kampf, 64. They fear actually lifting people from the depths of their present cultural and social misery because it would wrench from them their base of power.
So long as the militancy of disgruntled men can be channeled at an external enemy, tyrants retain power. Claiming to liberate men, Nazism and Islam.
Profane liberty with these words. If you don't join with us, we will crack your skull.
In the Hadith we find,
Ishaq, we attacked them fully armed, sharp swords in our hands, cutting through their heads and skulls. Ishaq, we were steadfast in trusting him. We have a prophet by whom we will conquer all men.
Der Führer was as fixated on Marxism as the prophet was on Judaism.
Mein Kampf, 65. I had a longing to penetrate the nucleus of this doctrine, but the official literature was of little use, for it lies.
Muhammad falsely condemned the Jews for lying too.
Ishaq, the Jews are a treacherous, lying, and evil people.
Sounding like Muhammad and his never-ending argument, Hitler protested like a schoolyard bully.
I was disgusted by their pettifogging methods in writing. Words with unclear content or unintelligible meaning were piled up ingeniously and meaninglessly. It is a dung heap of literary Dadaism. Theoretical untruth and nonsense, combined with sad, foreboding, and depressing fear, form a doctrine comprised of egoism and hatred. It could bring about the end of mankind. It is a doctrine of destruction.
This is an exacting description of the Quran.
Quran 2, verse 59. The
Jewish
transgressors changed and perverted the word from that which had been spoken to them to a word distorted. So we sent a plague among them from heaven for their evil doing.
Muhammad and Hitler epitomized what they protested. One rant simply followed another.
Mein Kampf, 66. Understanding Jewry alone is the key to comprehending the real intention of social democracy. He who knows race will raise the veil of false conceptions, and out of the mist and fog of empty phrases there rises the grinning, ugly face of Marxism.
Why do you suppose these men chose to annihilate Yahweh's chosen people? Coincidence? Jews had neither army nor country. They represented a tiny fraction of 1% of the earth's population. Yet one of these men ordered his followers to kill every Jew. The other nearly did.
Ishak, I pass judgment that their men shall be killed, their women and children made captives, and their property divided. Bukhari, so the prophet killed the Kareza men. He distributed their women, children, and property among the Muslims.
Hitler said,
Mein Kampf, 66. When I came upon the word Jew, I felt a slight dislike and could not ward off a disagreeable sensation which seized me whenever they were in my presence. Their external appearance had become human, but they had a strange religion.
Hitler would call them
half-wits, nags, malicious, envious annoyances,
and
dangerous, disgusting liars,
whose
smell makes me ill. Mein Kampf, 75. The physical uncleanliness of the chosen people was as repelling as their moral blemishes.
Muhammad said Allah committed
bestiality, turning Jews into apes and swine.
He said that Jews were
deaf, dumb, and blind.
And referring to the people of the book, he said,
they are a people in whose hearts is a disease.
Hitler said,
Mein Kampf, 75. The little Jew blinded by the sudden light was like a maggot in a rotting corpse. 76. Jews are a spiritual pestilence, infected with a disease worse than the Black Plague. They are spiritual and moral poison, the carriers of the worst sort of germs, infecting the minds of the world.
Bukhari, Allah's apostle said, plague is a means of torturing the Israelis.
Muhammad's Allah and Hitler's fate hated Yahweh's chosen. It's as if they thought they could hurt him by hurting them.
Mein Kampf, 79. Jews were cursed by fate. They were hit so hard by fate they have no understanding. Their boundless hate for themselves soiled their history and abused their heroes.
Ishak, the Jews were obstinate, so Allah revealed, people of the book, believe in what we have sent down, or we will efface your features, turning your face into your ass, cursing you.
Der Fuhrer justified his racism by suggesting that the Jews controlled the world's press and Marxism. Muhammad simply sent out his assassins to murder Jewish poets.
Mein Kampf, 80. I traced the names of the authors of Marxist papers, and they were all Jews. I became acquainted with their doctrine and used it as a weapon in the battle for my own internal conviction.
With every word, Hitler became more like Muhammad.
Mein Kampf, 81. It isn't possible to free a Jew from his convictions. I naively tried to make clear to them the madness of their ideas. I talked until my tongue was weary, but it only served to strengthen their determination. They refused to understand. Their glibness of tongue and skill for lying caused me to hate them.
The Quran also claimed that the Jews would never believe.
Ishak, Allah has sealed their hearts and their hearing, blinding them so that they will never find guidance. And that is because they have declared you a liar, and they do not believe in what has come down from their Lord. For opposing you, they will have an awful punishment.
Islam and Nazism were devoted to dehumanizing Jews.
Mein Kampf, 82. They are seducers who condemned truth and denied the word. They are not to be pitied, but to be given their due, to smash the seducer and corrupter against the wall.
Ishak, Allah increases their sickness. A tormented doom awaits the Jews. Allah said, they are mischief makers. They are fools. The Jews deny the truth and contradict what the apostle has brought. I will mock them and let them continue to wander blindly.
Mein Kampf and the Quran spew similar venom.
Mein Kampf, 82. Jews are victims of error, instigators of illness, led by devils incarnate, with the brains of a monster. They would destroy the world if not for the salvation of a fight with all the weapons at our disposal. They veil their thoughts and conceal their intentions.
Quran 2:64. But you Jews went back on your word and were lost losers. So some became apes, despised and hated. We made an example out of you. Ishak, the Jews are a treacherous, lying, and evil people. Quran 59:14. The Jews are devoid of sense. There is a grievous punishment awaiting them. Satan tells them not to believe, so they will end up in hell.
Muhammad changed his qibla from Jerusalem to Mecca, from pretending to be a Jewish prophet to being their most ardent enemy. Hitler said,
Mein Kampf, 83. This was the greatest change I was ever to experience inside me. I had turned into a fanatical anti-Semite. Destiny itself gave me the answer. The Jewish doctrine of Marxism is chaos. If the Jew is allowed to conquer humanity, his crown will be man's funeral wreath.
For Der Führer and Der Prophet, the elimination of the Jewish race was inspired.
Mein Kampf, 80. Eternal nature inexorably revenges the transgressors of her laws. I am acting on behalf of the Almighty Creator. By warding off the Jews, I am fighting for the Lord's work.
This leaves us with a rather unpleasant choice. Either there are two lords who despise Jews, or the Nazi and Islamic God are the same spirit. Hitler, like Muhammad, hated choice as much as he despised freedom.
Mein Kampf, 99. Democracy is a universal plague. It creates a monstrosity of filth and fire. Fate showed me how ridiculous a parliament is as an institution. 104. The invention of democracy is a crying shame. A majority can never replace the man.
The man. Never forget, Nazism, like Islam, was created to serve one man.
Mein Kampf, 106. The one true leader, provided by fate, is to be placed in that position.
Muhammad said this on behalf of his God.
Quran 2:104. You of
the Islamic
faith say not to the Prophet words of ambiguous report like, listen to us, but words of respect and obey him. To those who don't submit, there is a grievous punishment.
The core message of the Medina surahs is, submit and obey, fight and pay. Muhammad and Hitler thought that they were superior to the people they controlled. The Prophet called his people every derogatory word he knew. Hitler was slightly more refined.
Mein Kampf, 107. The mass of people are not sufficiently developed to arrive at a political opinion by themselves, and thus are not suited to select a leader. 113. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a great man to be discovered in an election. 116. Democracy shuns sunlight. Only a Jew could praise such a dirty and false institution.
Muhammad chose the grandiose titles of prophet, apostle, and messenger of God. Hitler followed suit, suggesting that he was called to be the oracle or messenger.
Mein Kampf, 117. The word Führer,
which means leader in German,
has a very special connotation. Der Führer is a man who gives expression to the divinity enshrined in his people. Der Führer speaks as the oracle or messenger of his dreams. Der Führer must have a feeling of certainty. He must not shrink from bloodshed or even war in pursuit of his goal. Der Führer is the German Messiah, whose kingdom is to last 1,000 years. He is like Christ. He must allow fate to dictate the course he is to pursue. Any German who resists Der Führer is a pariah, a blasphemer against Providence.
Muhammad wasn't the only tyrant with a messiah complex. Muhammad and Hitler were the only dictators who climbed to power by creating false and vicious religions.
Mein Kampf, 120. By using religious forces for political purposes, Der Führer awakens a spirit most would not have believed possible. 123. But once it is in danger of being oppressed, it is justified in fighting with all available weapons. For any man who is not willing to fight, righteous providence has already decreed his doom. The world is not intended for the cowardly.
Good Nazis and good Muslims fight.
Quran 2, verse 191. Oppression is worse than killing. Bukhari. The Prophet said, a single endeavor of fighting in Allah's cause is better than the world and whatever is in it. Quran 9:88. The messenger and those who believe with him strive hard and fight with their wealth and lives in Allah's cause. Quran 9:5. Fight and kill the disbelievers wherever you find them. Take them captive, harass them, lie in wait and ambush them using every stratagem of war.
Hitler, like someone else we know, possessed a delusional self-image.
Mein Kampf, 134. Only the best and most courageous characters are suited to act as leaders. If the fight for the new view of life is not led by heroes, then death-defying fighters will not be found.
Both men had a rather nasty habit of overhyping themselves and their causes in hopes of attracting warriors.
Mein Kampf 135. The mission of a successful movement is to gain leaders and fighters. It must embrace its destiny with force, defiance, and martyrdom. It must fight, not negotiate.
Quran 8:57. Inflict on them such a defeat as would be a lesson for others, that they may be warned. If you apprehend treachery from a people with whom you have a treaty, retaliate by breaking it off.
Continuing to connect fighting to religion, Hitler proclaimed,
Mein Kampf 127. With religious conviction, the bearers of the new doctrine must declare themselves ready and willing to fight. 128. The will to fight, using all instruments of power, gains favor and draws the greatest possible advantage to the movement. 132. Greatness wins new fighters for the cause, and they are rewarded with success.
Quran 8, verse 65. O Prophet, urge the faithful to fight. Quran 9, verse 5. Slay the infidels wherever you find them. Take them captive and besiege them. Quran 8, verse 69. Know that the use of spoils is lawful and good.
Suggestive and impassioned speech served both men. Their lives became a performance in which they played the starring role.
Mein Kampf 136. The masses will always succumb to the force of the spoken word. They need volcanic eruptions of passion and spiritual sensations stirred by the cruel god of misery and the fiery word.
Hitler's words, like Mohammed's before him, served as a confession. The
cruel god of misery
was Satan. He seduced men with fiery-tongued accomplices.
Mein Kampf 137. Only a storm of burning passion can turn people's destinies. Only he who harbors passion in himself can arouse passion. Passion will be given to him by the cruel god of misery. He will choose him and will give him the words that beat like a hammer, words that will open the hearts of men. The passionate speaker has been chosen by heaven as a prophet to do his will.
Hitler saw himself as a
prophet chosen by the cruel god of misery.
One called to recite the heavenly revelations of a
new view of life.
One called to incite violent passions so that men would fight for his cause. As such, he was the very reincarnation of Muhammad.
Ishaq, Allah's apostle, the Lord of the Muslims, leader of the Allah-fearing, messenger of the Lord of the worlds, the peerless and unequaled. Quran 4:65. They can have no faith until they make you, Muhammad, judge in all disputes, and find in their souls no resistance against your decisions, accepting them with complete submission.
Hitler could have saved himself a lot of trouble. Had he dusted off the Quran's war surah, he could have dispensed with Mein Kampf. Replace Arabs with Aryans, Mecca with Munich, and Prophet with Führer, and the rest remains the same. The cruel god of misery is a more fitting title for Allah's tormented spirit anyway. Fear, submission, and obedience take their rightful place in both men's quest to gratify their flesh. The Quran and Mein Kampf were inspired by the same spirit and for the same purpose. They are equally false, intolerant, racist, hateful, and violent. While the original disciples of both men conquered much of the world, one religious doctrine lives on, and it continues to inflame terrorists everywhere. As the beneficiary of the largest transfer of wealth in human history, $1 billion a day, Islam is on the verge of acquiring the weapons of mass destruction it needs to fulfill its destiny. Hitler, Mein Kampf, and Nazism gave us a taste of what awaits us. Unless we come to see Muhammad, the Quran, and Islam in the same light and eliminate their influence, the world will erupt in a war more hellish than we can imagine.